Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Wheat Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
What are you getting so crazy about? It's just music.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to welcome Calexico, a band that fuses world music with rock and roll.
Plus, Greg and I will review the new albums from two rock giants, AC/DC and Bob Dylan. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
I always feel like somebody's watching me, and I have no privacy. Whoa, I always feel like somebody's watching me. Tell me, is it just a dream?
Yes, Rockwell was right. Big Brother is watching you. That's at least according to an entertainment media research study, one of the leading European entertainment consultants. Just conducted a massive survey of download activity in the UK and other European countries, and it found that 61% of illegal downloaders said they believed they were being monitored by their internet service provider, and 72% said they would stop downloading music if they got one of those scary warning letters from their ISP basically saying, we're going to cut off your internet service if you don't stop downloading. What this means is that the tide may be turning in the record industry's war against their consumers who are downloading music illegally. In the past 5 years, the record industry has been sending out countless warning letters, subpoenas, fines, basically saying, you're going to pay unless you stop downloading. Consumers have been paying to the tune of $3,000 to $5,000 if they get caught, but the vast majority of people are totally ignoring the record industry's warning letters and continuing to download at a pace of 20 to 1 illegal downloads to legal downloads. Now, however, the internet service providers are being asked to be involved. Some of the leading industry figures have asked internet service providers to start warning their customers and say, if you don't stop downloading music, we're going to cut off your service to the internet. And this seems to be working.
This puts the ISPs on the level of, like, the United States Postal Service.
Yeah.
It's a felony to send, like, threats through the mail. But it gets back to the very question of, is downloading a crime?
Exactly. But this is what a lot of leading advocates in the music industry have been saying for the last 6 or 7 months. Paul McGuinness gave a big speech at the Meetum Music Conference in France earlier this year, the manager of U2, basically saying the ISPs have got to start telling their consumers that basically they are robbing us blind and that they need to stop, otherwise they will not get internet service. And it seems to be getting some traction. Now we're seeing this happening in Europe. It's only a matter of time, I think, before it gets to the United States. Other interesting aspects of the study, teenage downloaders continue to download music in record numbers. And one of the big reasons that they're saying they're downloading so much illegal music is because the legitimate digital stores, the iTunes of the world, if you will, are not complete enough. They don't offer enough music that they want. So in other words, they're going to other sources to find this music. So once again, the music industry has had 8 years to try and satisfy their customers, and according to this survey, are still not doing a very good job of it.
Ray Craig, I have another story about another study out of the UK, which is of particular interest to us. The cliche is you are what you eat. Well, in our world at Sound Opinions, you are what you listen to. We know you by the music you love most. Now we have a scientific study from Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. Professor Adrian North is in the psychology department there, and he did this extensive study of 36,000 people from around the world, collating the kind of music they love most with certain personality traits, kind of making science out of, you know, if you're a death metal fan, you're this kind of person. Well, we thought it would be fascinating to get some insight on this from Professor North. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thanks very much.
Why don't we start with you explaining this study to us? What was the goal going in, and what have you gotten so far in your research?
Sure. I mean, we already know, of course, it's common sense that everybody uses music in some way to define themselves. You only have to look at kind of young kids who go around wearing lots of kind of black clothes and eyeliner, for instance, or a variety of other kind of clothing styles, if you like, to see that a great many people, to some extent, define themselves through music. So what we wanted to do in this research was just to look and see specifically how does music relate to how you feel about yourself, and particularly how does it relate to your personality. We asked people to visit a website where, first of all, they just rated how much they liked each of 104 different musical styles, which we picked from right the way around the world. And then people did a fairly short personality test for us, which is called the Big Five, which gives you a score for each person in terms of the extent to which they're creative, hardworking, outgoing, gentle, and also at ease with themselves. And all we did then was just put those two sets of data together. How does liking for each of those 104 different musical styles link to different types of personality?
Would you say that the research proved a lot of the anecdotal evidence about what people already think? Well, you listen to classical music, you're a certain type of person, or you listen to heavy metal, and you're a certain type of person. Would you say you are?
Yeah, kind of yes and no, really. I mean, in some respects, what we found was absolutely what you'd expect. For example, I mean, as you mentioned, heavy metal, that was a nice example from our work. We found that heavy metal fans really did have lower levels of self-esteem than did the group of people as a whole, if you like. But there are also some quite interesting, surprising findings in there, too. I mean, for instance, if you compare the heavy metal and classical music fans of all things, that they bizarrely had a fair amount of stuff in common in their personalities. For example, they both tended to be groups of people who were relatively creative. They both tended to be relatively at ease with themselves as well, and that, you know, there are other similarities too. So I would say, in some respects, we didn't conform the stereotype, but in others, of course, yeah, absolutely we did.
Well, this is why we were eager to talk to you, Professor. As two rock critics, Greg Kot and I have spent our lives sussing people out. You can tell us your three favorite bands in the world, and we know you.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Again, it's another nice bit about this research. I mean, what clearly it does tell you indeed is exactly that. If you tell someone just your musical preferences, maybe what that allows you to do is to infer a fair amount about their personality. Well, particularly what these results tell us in raw statistical terms, you can infer around about 12% of their personality completely just by knowing the music that they like. So, yeah, as these things go, that's a pretty good guide.
Yeah, I've always said, you know, if your car breaks down, you need help changing your tire, you want it to happen at a heavy metal concert. Because these people, as you found in your research, are gentle, they're generally sweet.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think that's one other interesting thing that comes out of this, particularly when you look at fans of not just heavy metal, but also the fans of rap that took part in our study. And, you know, of course, the fans of both those styles are subject to some fairly kind of nasty stereotypes, not just in Britain, but also in the US as well, I know, and you know, pretty well throughout the Western world. And again, what I think is interesting is that there's no real group of fans that came out as completely bad, if you like. I mean, sure, there were some that came out the nicer than others. I mean, I think overall, off the top of my head, I think it was our fans of jazz and soul who overall came out as being the most, mm-hmm. like, kind of the best well-adjusted personalities. But like I say, fans of rap and fans of heavy metal had plenty to recommend themselves. For example, our fans of heavy metal, off the top of my head, came out as being relatively outgoing relative to most groups of people. They came out as being, generally speaking, quite gentle people as well. So it's this stereotype that we often have of fans of rock and rap as being these kind of raucous types just really doesn't hold water.
Professor, one of the challenges that Greg and I have had in our view of the world based entirely on music is that one thing we're seeing with Generation Y, largest group of teenagers in history in America since their parents, the baby boomers, is this increasing thing. You know, Greg and I will go talk to a high school class and we'll say, well, what do you guys listen to? And they say, and we hate this, everything.
Yeah.
And by that, they do not mean they are voracious listeners. They mean they copy whatever's on their friend's iPod, and they're not increasingly not defining themselves with the music they love.
I wouldn't say as much that people aren't defining themselves with the music they love, but I would say that these groups are based on much more kind of eclectic mixes of music, where it's much harder these days to identify kind of common musical characteristics that link them all together. But there's still kind of a strong subculture that's in there. A good example of that is the rise of the emo subculture. It isn't just about loud guitars and kind of, you know, gloomy lyrics. It's much broader based than that. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean to say that the music isn't part of it. There's just a whole bunch of other components that go with it. I think one of the points worth making here as well is one thing we deliberately looked at in this search is precisely this point you make, whereby, you know, musical tastes are much less tightly defined around one very specific style these days. And one thing we looked at very specifically, I mentioned earlier on, we've got this measure of how creative people are. And one interesting thing that we found is that the higher the overall liking ratings that people gave for all 104 musical styles, so the higher they tend to score on this measure of creativity and broad-mindedness as well, which suggests that, you know, kind of musical broad-mindedness extends itself to broad-mindedness in your worldview in general.
Well, that raises an interesting issue, Professor North. What are the implications for your study in terms of the way people are consuming music these days? Obviously, we've seen a huge decline in CD sales. People are downloading more music than ever, but they're not necessarily paying for it. Do you see any correlations between what's going on here in this study and the way people are consuming music?
I think certainly what this kind of finding really kind of lends itself towards is these market segmentation strategies that, of course, record companies have been using for a long time now. They don't focus on one particular artist so much, but they focus on, if you like, almost a group of consumers with a whole range of outlooks on the world, you know, that lead them to particular media preferences and a whole variety of different brand and a whole variety of more general commercial preferences. For instance, one of the findings of our research was that, you know, unsurprisingly, our jazz fans came out as being really quite creative people relative to the population as a whole. But what that tells you is that if this group of people are creative, then that means you should be marketing a new jazz release as being, for example, groundbreaking, innovative, unfamiliar, new, novel. And that's just the kind of thing that's going to appeal to its target market.
So, Professor, you've never told us what you like personally. I mean, how does this jibe with your personal taste? Do you agree with what it says about you as a music listener?
I don't really know, but certainly for sure, I tend to like indie. Of all the musical styles that we covered in the research, I suppose I technically qualify as an indie fan, which I guess means they've got kind of low self-esteem. I don't know if that's true or not. Relatively creative? Well, maybe. I don't know. Not hardworking. Don't tell my boss, at least.
You're a professor. You're the head of the department. You've written a book. I'd say you're pretty hardworking and creative.
Well, as long as you'll let me have that in writing so I can pass it on to my bosses here, that would be wonderful, yeah.
Okay, will do. Thank you so much, Professor.
Cheers, pleasure.
That could only be one band. That is the immortal AC/DC, with those same chords played again the same way
drum beat, yeah,
as they have for 33 years. Since 1975, AC/DC, originally out of Australia, now with band members spread across three continents, has made records and has been selling lots of them.
200 million worldwide.
You know, many people may not believe that, but 200 million records, that is a staggering number of records, including 42 million copies alone of their biggest seller, Back in Black, their 1980 release. Now they've got a new album out. It's called Black Ice. It's going to be available exclusively at Walmart stores. They're following in the footsteps, improbably enough, of the Eagles, whose Long Road Out of Eden was also only available out of Walmart, a double disc that sold 3.5 million copies. Nobody's buying CDs anymore. Well, the Eagles proved them wrong, and now AC/DC is saying, I think our fans are going to follow suit. They still buy our CDs. AC/DC is one of the few bands out there that has actually taken a stand and said, we're not going to make available any digital downloads of this record. We are not going to sell individual tracks on iTunes, and you can only get it at Walmart, and you can only buy it as a CD. Mm. One thing we need to point out about this band, Angus and Malcolm Young, the guitar players in this band, have been doing it together for 33 years, as we said, and this is one of the classic hard rock bands of all time. We're going to be back with a review of Black Ice in a minute, but let's play a song from it first. It's called Spoilin' for a Fight by AC/DC on Sound Opinions.
When I'm coming to a fall, sliding down a road,
Spoiling for a Fight by the immortal AC/DC from the new album Black Ice. Greg, I only made the argument last week on the show when we were talking about Oasis that when a band is so devoted to a formula, I just don't see the point after a while of buying a new album when it's exactly like the last one. There are two exceptions, I think, really high on the list, the Ramones and AC/DC, because the formula is so simple and brilliant. I just can't get enough of it. It's like having too much beer in the fridge. There is no such thing. You know what I mean? How can you have too much beer in your refrigerator? You can't. You can't have too much AC/DC in your collection. It hardly even matters that there are no fewer than four songs on this record about rock and roll. There's a rock and roll train. There's a rock and roll dream. There's Rocking All the Way. And, of course, there's the girl. She likes rock and roll. It's stupid. It's about booze. It's about sex.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I love it to pieces. The only thing that I say, shame on them, is this Walmart. You know, I don't want to have to walk into that store to buy this record. But, you know, nevertheless, this is a buy-it quality record.
You know, I think a lot of people are going to buy it. I hate to speculate about the marketplace, but I think it is going to be a huge, huge album. And just the fact that there's still this incredible appetite for their back catalog indicates to me that there's an incredible appetite for anything AC/DC is going to release this year. I mean, this is their first album in 8 years. People have been anticipating this.
I let me just interject. It's not that I'm against Walmart. It's that, you know, let's think of all those mom and pop stores around the world that have been selling AC/DC records for 30 years and making that band money. And then this band spits in their face by saying, you can't have mom and pop, you know, you can't have this record. You have to, you know, it's only going to Walmart.
Yeah, it's silly. I think it's a bad move. As for the music, Brian Johnson, the lead singer, is essentially there to scream his lungs out. He's not there to worry. He's not there to confess his, you know, the world is going to pot. He's not there to think. I mean, this is basically a sound, and it is a great sound. What Brendan O'Brien, the producer, has gotten back to is that Robert John Mutt Lang sound of the late 70s, early 80s, when Lang was producing Back in Black and Highway to Hell.
Yeah.
He was cleaning up the sound where there was this great separation between the instruments. There was a lot of space around them. And that's what Brendan O'Brien has gotten back to. He is not reinventing AC/DC in any way. There's a touch of strings on one song, and that's enough to make AC/DC fans faint. They're going to go, oh, my God, there's something different about that song. But otherwise, this is basically a 1980 vintage AC/DC record. Phil Rudd and Cliff Williams, nobody knows who they are. They've been in this band forever. But what a great rhythm section on top of Malcolm Young's rhythm guitar. The only thing I would fault this record for, Highway to Hell and Back in Black, they were 10 songs about 40 minutes each.
Yeah.
What we have here is about 15 songs in 55 minutes. I realize it's the CD age, you want to add stuff, but you know, I want a short, sharp fist to the face that's over in about 40 minutes, and I think this album would have been a lot better, would have been amazing if it was about a third less long.
But still, we rate things on Buy It, Burn It, Trash It. I gave it a Buy It.
I don't think it's a buy it.
Oh!
I don't think it's a buy it because there's 15 songs. I said I think you need to burn those 10 songs.
Wow!
So I'm going to tell AC/DC fans, don't go to Walmart. Find this thing online and
you
burn
are
those 10 great songs.
Biggest AC/DC fan, and you're not in their corner?
I'm absolutely in their corner. I just think they should have had five less songs on this record.
So that's a buy it from me and a burn it from Greg on AC/DC. Up next on Sound Opinions, we sit down with the band Calexico, and later on we'll review the latest in Bob Dylan's bootleg series. That's in a minute from Sound Opinions on Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Greg, one of our favorite bands in indie rock today is the group Calexico from Tucson, originally formed by Joey Burns and John Convertino as an offshoot of Giant Sand. They were doing time in that band led by Hal Gelb. I think they've become one of the premier bands of Southwest Americana, mixing rock and roll and American roots music, jazz, Ennio Morricone's spaghetti western soundtracks. They are one of the most ambitious groups on the scene today. We spent some time in the Jim and Kay Maybe studio with Calexico. Band members Joey Burns, John Convertino, Paul Niehaus, Jacob Valenzuela, Martin Wenk, and Volker Zander. Hi, guys. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having us here. It's great to be here.
Sixth studio album just out on Chicago's Quarter Stick Records, Carried to Dust. Why don't we start with this is being positioned as kind of a return to form after the more kind of pop accessible rock sound of the last record. Was there a goal going into the studio to make this one?
Not really. This is Joey, by the way. Hi. There was really no goal, just to try to come up with some good songs and to kind of go back to the way we've done things in the past, where we just start off with John Convertino on the drums and myself on guitar. And
20 years you guys have been working.
It's been a while, yeah. So we just kind of write and record at the same time. We don't rehearse.
It's a little different, though, in the sense that this current sextet that we're here with in the studio has kind of gelled into like the most permanent lineup of the long history of Calexico.
For about 10 years, yeah. Yep. So it's been good. And I think the goal was just to get some real basic recordings, you know, just to record at WaveLab, which we've done on all the previous records, and also to have Craig Schumacher of WaveLab mix the record. And I think his mixing probably is that familiarity that some of the fans have come to know and love.
Is that a sound you could get anywhere else besides that studio in Arizona?
I'm sure we could. If we had Craig and his wacky sensibilities, be easy.
There does seem to be a sound that comes out of that studio. We were talking to Nico Case a year or two ago about recording there, and she's pretty smitten with that place as well.
It's laid back. It's pretty comfortable. You can kick your shoes up on the furniture, and you can bring your dogs in, and they can pee on the floor, eat the cables, and they don't mind.
Joey, you and John, this partnership really started around 1990.
Mm-hmm.
You started out as kind of a rhythm section. I kind of looked at you guys as a kind of an indie rock mini version of Booker T and the MGs or something like that.
Sly playing
a lot
and
of
Robbie,
sessions and things like
those
that.
Those are nice compliments. Thank you very much, guys. John and I met through a mutual friend in L.A., and we were playing with Hal Gelb of Giant Sand for John probably 13 years and me for about 10 years, and started off playing in L.A. and then touring around, you know, Europe and the States. And then everybody kind of gradually migrated to Tucson, which is a very laid-back, small town, and it's been going well.
How did it evolve from rhythm section into songwriting?
It involved, I think, collecting old instruments. John loves old accordions, marimbas, old drums, and we just started stockpiling them. We go to the Chicago Music Store downtown Tucson and rescue a few of these kind of beaten and broken and dusty instruments and repair them, bring them back to life.
It was called the Chicago Music Store, but it's downtown Tucson?
That's right.
That makes no sense, but okay.
So just adding these instruments to your personal collection, that sort of inspired the songwriting?
It did. It did indeed. Each instrument kind of brings in its own flair and flavor and character. And, you know, not that we're really experts at all these instruments. I played some cello in high school. I wound up buying a mandolin and, you know, just kind of tinkering on these instruments and adding little textures here and there on some of the early recordings. And it wasn't until 98 when we recorded The Black Light, where we brought in musicians that played violin and trumpet and pedal steel, that really kind of brought forth this bigger ensemble.
Well, before we continue with the conversation, why don't we get a song from Calexico? What are you guys going to play?
I guess we'll start off with Two Silver Trees. 1, 2, 3, 4...
Thank you.
Two Silver Trees by Calexico. I gotta ask about the John Fante connection. Fante's great novelist. I've always thought kind of the missing link between Hubert Selby and Jim Thompson, sort
yeah,
of. So there's a connection there. Ask the Dust was his novel.
Right.
Carried to Dust, title of this sixth Calexico record. What was the inspiration there?
I think just the novel itself, the story of this Italian immigrant, fledgling writer, starting out in Los Angeles, writing everything from heart loss to no money, no job. Earthquake in Long Beach, California. His true love runs off with another writer out to the California desert of Joshua Tree. And through all this, there's some there's some resolve. There's some moral here at work.
And this is, like, in your head, is this the ideal soundtrack to that ordeal?
No, I think the title came after the record was finished and we were kind of racking our brains, wondering what to call this. And John came up with the title. And I looked online, and I accidentally typed carried by dust, and then I found the definition for electricity. Hmm. And I thought that was great, and then John wrote back saying, no, it's carried to dust.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, ah, now that's poetic.
Yeah. You guys have a knack for that sort of thing. This is, as you've just described, Joey, a more personal record from that standpoint. Garden Ruin, the previous record, was kind of viewed as a little bit more of a political statement for you guys, unusual for you in terms of that kind of content in your lyrics. And also the sound was, as Jim had alluded to earlier, a little bit more of a pop-oriented record.
This world's an ungodly place.
It is sort of the record that probably Calexico fans gravitate toward when it's sort of an us against them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like it's the love it or hate it Calexico record. How do you view it now?
I think that's a great sign. You know, for a long time, a lot of our records, people just kind of, they found something in there that either their grandparents or their parents or their kids liked. And I think we just kind of wanted to shake the definition of what our band was or could be at that time. And there's a lot of frustration, I think, just globally and nationally here at home. And I think we were all feeling it artistically, and it kind of wound up, balled up into this record called Garden Ruin, which I like a lot. And I think a lot of people that maybe were on the fence about our band liked it, and then those that didn't. You know, we love working, and so there's never a drought with the music for Calexico.
Well, it's true. From writing a song for Nancy Sinatra to serving essentially as the backing band for I'm Not There, that Mock Dylan biopic. I mean, you guys do a lot of projects outside that all seem to bring something back to the group when you reconvene.
And for me, it's just all part of the big picture. It's just what we do. And I know, you know, when you look at a record, then, you know, that's a very defined moment, and it's kind of a slice of what's going on in people's lives. But I kind of look at things more long term, I guess.
You know, when you came out, started putting records out in 94, very distinctive sound. And I think one of the things you were talking about earlier with Garden Ruin is how you were sort of maybe blowing up some of the stereotypes about what the band was. But I love looking back on just the, there's a whole dictionary of words that have been used to describe what Calexico is and what they sound like, mm-hmm. and you're laughing. Is there one that sticks under your skin in terms of just like, that is the weirdest, mm-hmm. where did they pull that one out of?
I think one of those that kind of stood out early on was from a good friend of ours, Fred Mills, who's a writer, and he came up with Desert Noir.
Yeah,
and I thought that was pretty creative, and it stuck for a long time, and I guess it still kind of applies, but you know, we've got members that are living in Europe, and so there is a bigger outlook, a bigger perspective, I think, and I think that kind of factors in. It always has for me. You know, I think John and I grew up in households where, you know, it wasn't just rock music being played. You know, John's mom and dad both played music professionally and taught music. John's Italian immigrant connection, much like John Fante. I mean, it shows through in John's playing. Mm-hmm. He is stirring the soup, literally, back there. I turn around sometimes and I see you, and he's got one hand held out like he's a quarterback or something, you know, the Statue of Liberty or something.
Right, so we're getting into this, Stu. We got the mix of weird instruments, the kind of literary Fante thing, and then also I hear wine. I hear you guys have become huge wine snobs, and this is sort of like an Oneophiles tour of South America, this record.
We're hoping that,
is that right?
We'll get to do a tour of some vineyards, and we're looking at California first.
Yeah.
We love the wine, and we love the food, and that's one of the perks, I guess, of touring so yeah. much. And you know, there's always going to be packaged sandwiches backstage for you, but it's nice to kind of get out and explore, and I think that kind of goes with the territory. And I think most certainly everybody, especially Folker and Martin here, you know, they have nice tastes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wine snobs.
Equal opportunity wine drinker.
You?
Yeah.
Did Nico tell you?
why don't we have another song?
All right. This song has nothing to do with wine. But if you drink too much, you probably wind up where this character winds up. This is The News About William. You guys ready?
Walks asleep, dogs on the porch, and spiders on the leaf. Shipwrecked by night, sailing through days. Nobody noticed them slipping away. Connecting the dots. Boarded up the windows with pain and with pride. The music box broken that once was his soul. It's sad little song spinning out of control. Mm-hmm. closed both his eyes and pointed straight south. The second line drums marched into the sea, while the clouds overhead cried mutiny. They parted for Kathy and her bitter news, and as I was filled, the sky grew dim, recalling how close to that exit I'd been. Hours not to reply.
That's the news about William from Calexico live on Sound Opinions. If you'd like to comment on anything in our conversation with Calexico or anything else in the show, give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800, or send us an email at interact@soundopinions.org. We're going to be back after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with more of Calexico. And later on, Jim and I are going to rate the new Bob Dylan record. Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. You're listening to a conversation and live performance from Calexico. You know, this Tucson band has never been easy to pin down, a sound that has been all over the map, and I asked Joey Burns whether or not that was a goal from the start, to have this wide-open sound. Did you have all this in mind when the band first got together? I mean, getting back to that, we were joking about the Desert Noir,
right.
All the superlatives and adjectives people were hurling at what this sounds like. It was distinctive, though. And did you have that sense that, you know, we're not going to start a band unless we can truly do something that's our own thing and sets us apart from everybody else out there? I mean, was that the thinking going on back then?
No, I think just following your instinct, what it is that you want to hear, and that same kind of experimentation into playing some of these acoustic instruments and carving out something that is, in some ways, you know, has creative arrangements and interesting combinations of instruments going on. And of course, using instrumentals has been very successful for us, with songs being licensed into films and TV. And it's just fun, you know. I mean, we're players. We love playing. And we like collaborating with other musicians, too, whether they're singers or players. And I think that kind of getting just... For me, getting lost into the tone of some of these instruments and the combinations that we have here, what they kind of make up, and how to feature different instruments on different songs or voices, and just kind of keep that variety going. That's what propelled me, and still does.
So when you're writing the songs, are you envisioning that sound in your head as well? I mean, I assume you're writing on you're writing on an acoustic guitar, let's
right,
say, whatever.
For the most part, yeah.
And do you hear the rest of that orchestration and texture in your head when you're writing the song?
I hear mostly mood and melody. That kind of gets me going first. And then, you know, for me, I love putting more and more overdubs on top. And John's like, remember that first rough mix when it was just guitar and drums and no bass and just, you know.
Can we get back and to get, that?
And John kind of brings in the air and the ambiance and the spontaneity and really, for me, keeps things grounded. Right, John? Thumbs up. John's got a sore throat today, so he's not talking.
Also, we've walled him in as the drummer.
That's right. And John is a unique drummer because right now in his hands, he's got a pair of wire brushes with the wooden handles. He gets a really unique sound with the brushes because he's also, I guess, these rubber bands and kind of clamps the edge where or the part where the wire meets the wood and kind of has a little more density there so he can get it a good thwap on like that crash cymbal or something.
Can we hear a little bit of that?
Let's hear that,
John.
Can you hear a thwap? There you go.
That's a soft. He's a dynamic drummer, this John.
If we had John Bonham playing with brushes, it would sound not unlike that.
You want some Bonham? He'll give you
There's
some Bonham.
There's your new direction right there. 2009.
The next Calexico record, the template has been set.
Why don't you give us another tune? What are
Sure. I was thinking we would do a song that Jacob here wrote, and it's sung in Spanish. It's called Inspiración.
Well, are the horns, are we right to call them mariachi, or is that completely
Not on this song, you can't. Yeah. You'll get taxed.
Okay.
You'll get a parking ticket.
Okay.
You're in big trouble if you do that. And no, this is more Cuban style, Afro-Cuban style, by way of South Tucson. So you guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, here we go.
Y tú, mi amigo, me inspiras mis pasos. Me voy por el mundo conociendo varias gente, pero nunca hay una persona. Estoy aquí. Si pudieras mirarme, ¿qué pensarás de mí? Pero hoy es muy tarde para decirte que soy cambiado. Me puede, me duele que ya no estás aquí. Ya es muy tarde para decirte que soy cambiado. Ya es muy tarde para decirte que soy cambiado. Me puede, me duele que ya no estás aquí.
Calexico on Sound Opinions. Beautiful stuff from the Carried to Dust record. We want to say thanks to all the members of Calexico. Joey Burns, John Convertino, Paul Niehaus, Jacob Valenzuela, Martin Venk, and Volker Sander for being here today. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Opinions.
Fat man looking at a shining steel. Thin man looking at his last meal. Holler man looking in a cotton field for dignity. Wise man looking at a blade of grass. A young man looking in the shadows that pass. Poor man looking through painted glass. For dignity.
That is Bob Dylan with the song Dignity, originally released on the Oh Mercy album in 1989, now appearing in a radically different version, stripped down with just the piano, on the eighth installment of his bootleg series called Telltale Signs. Just came out. It's a double disc set. Part of this series, which previously has focused on a lot of Dylan's 60s outtakes, rarities, live recordings, this one is devoted to that period, primarily culled from the recording sessions of three albums, Oh Mercy in 1989, Time Out of Mind in 1997, and Modern Times in 2006, a period that many critics, Greg, hailed as a late career renaissance. Now we're getting alternate versions, we're getting live takes, we're getting songs that were left off of the recordings. This is Dylan in what John Perella has recently called his wandering, God-haunted, apocalyptic philosopher phase. He knows he's coming to the end of the road. He's commenting on that, and he's doing it in grand form. Let's play a song. We don't often do best-of collections or rarities collections, live albums. This is almost like a new Dylan album. That's why we're talking about it. Listen to High Water for Charlie Patton, a live recording with Dylan and the band of that song on Sound Opinions.
I want to rise another day. All the golden food being stolen away. Turn out looking east and west from who above his mind. I'll stay alive. Nothing stands down. I want to rise. Texas sliding down. Folks are losing their possessions. Folks are leaving town. But the basic shaking, broken, that she hanging on the wall.
High Water for Charlie Patton, a live version of that Bob Dylan track from the new Dylan record, Telltale Signs, rare and unreleased 1989-2006. Just one of many alternative versions of Dylan tracks from the last 16, 17 years. As you said, Jim, an important period in Dylan's career, one of the few artists that can be said to be having a renaissance of this magnitude, where the records that he's been making in the last decade plus have been compared very favorably to his greatest work from the 60s, mm-hmm. and with good reason. This presents the alternative to those records in a lot of ways. It's fascinating. The material is that rich and that good that to hear these alternative versions makes this a new Dylan record for me in many ways.
Yeah.
It's like hearing that 90s period when he was coming back in a new light. Particularly strong, I think, are those live tracks. You mentioned the power of that version of High Water for Charlie Patton, which I think blows away the studio version, which wasn't bad, from the Love and Theft record.
But he had that great band that he was touring with and really exploding guitars on stage night after night, and yet he wasn't making those studio records with that group.
Well, he started using the studio musicians on the last couple of records, but I think he really figured out how to play those songs once he laid them down
on stage,
in the studio.
Yeah.
And on stage, he really got a sense of where to go and the power of those tracks. Really reminds me of those surging moments that he would get when he was touring with the Hawks in those pre-band days of the mid-60s, when he was going electric and everybody was trying to make sense of it. At the same time, you know, we heard that alternate version of Dignity, a track which was gussied up by Daniel Lanois in the studio for the Oh Mercy record. Just hearing it in that sort of saloon version where it's just him and an upright piano playing that song, stripping it way back. Fascinating to hear that. This is a great record. I'm buy it all the way on this one. It's like new music from Dylan, even though it is picking through the archives of the last 16, 17 years.
I had some problems with the Daniel Lanois productions on two of those three albums that this record covers. You know, it was kind of this swamp bog, and Dylan strips all of that away. It's either him and the voice and the piano, or him and the voice and the acoustic guitar or harmonica. I prefer these versions in a lot of ways. Those records weren't bad. I didn't necessarily think they were the runaway brilliant masterpieces that some critics hailed. The point is, at age 67, Dylan is still having fun. You can hear, even as he plays that I'm about to die, I'm the old man at the end of the road, I have all this wisdom to share, kids. Even as he's playing that heavy philosopher role, he's winking, he's smiling. You can hear that on these versions where you can't necessarily hear that on the studio albums. We rate things buy it, burn it, trash it on our sound opinion scale. Absolutely a buy it album, a double buy it for Bob Dylan. What do we have next week on the show, Greg?
Next week, Jim, we're going to get the lab coats out of the closet. We are going to become the rock doctors once again and help a needy music patient find some great new music.
We have some thank yous to say, Mr. Cott. Calexico was recorded by Mary Gaffney and Sarah Toulouse. Our ace production team is, as always, Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. And our fearless leader, our executive producer, Tori Southside Malatia. You know, we tried to put his personality into Dr. North's scale, and it just blew up the chart. I don't know what that meant.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 1-888-859-1800.
Come on, Anna. Answer your phone, girl. Answer your phone. Pick up the receiver.
New messages.
Hi, this is Zach from Chicago, and I have a comment about the James Bond theme songs. The three songs that were done by John Barry, which were two by Shirley, sung by Shirley Bassey, and one by Nancy Sinatra. Obviously, those two by Shirley Bassey are great. The one by Nancy Sinatra did not precede Goldfinger, though. Goldfinger came out in 64, and You Only Live Twice was after that.
You. So it seems.
Nancy Sinatra, she does sing a great tune with that one, but, I mean, come on. Is she really as talented as any of the songwriters who wrote her songs? I mean, really. I mean, John Barry and Lee Hazlewood. I mean, come on. And she's not the godmother of punk rock either. So where you came up with that opinion is really beyond me. Other than that, good show. Thanks.
Hi, this is Dan calling from Chicago. In your talk about favorite James Bond theme songs, you left out the Welsh Lion, Tom Jones, singing Thunderball in all his hairy-chested glory when he hits that high note. Sends shivers down my spine. Thanks.
So he strikes like thunder.
This is Angela Sims from the South Side of Chicago. Caught your show, as I usually do. Caught this last one, Psychedelic Soul. It was outstanding. The research and new history that you guys did was really great. I've been around for most of that history, and it was wonderful to have someone acknowledge all the guys who have contributed to this and descendants of it, and it was absolutely great. I had my 16-year-old listening so she could get a good understanding of how hip-hop came into be and, you know, the influences. Outstanding show. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Six.
Hi, this is Richard Wagle. Just commenting on the psychedelic soul. I don't know if it's sacrilegious, but for me, the first real psychedelic soul I encountered was the pinball song on Sesame Street. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I think the Pointer Sisters sang it, but the visuals were definitely psychedelic, and it had that sort of funk jazz rhythm to it. And it's probably that song that sent me out to buy all those funkadelic albums and 70s funk compilations that I can't get enough of these days. So that's my personal origin of psychedelic soul. So I thought I'd share it with you. Love the show. Bye.
I love it. Hey, this is Jen from Brooklyn calling, and I'm just catching up on a month's worth of Sound Opinions. And I heard the wedding song piece, and I just wanted to say, if I didn't totally agree with Greg Cott all the time before, I officially have a crush on him now, because I Only Have Eyes for You is the most romantic song of all time. And on A Bronx Tale soundtrack, there's a version where it starts out a cappella with the Complexions and then sort of morphs into the Flamingos version, and you just have to sit down when that happens.
I only have eyes for you.
Jim, I don't know what's going on with you. I think you really need medical attention. I mean, the banana smoothie thing was just scary, and maybe it's a symptom of Eno-itis or something. Anyway, take care, Jen. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.